Six Music.
BBC Radio, Six Music Documentaries.
And welcome to the first time on Six Music with me, Matt Everett. This is where we meet some of the most influential figures in music and take a look at the pivotal first moments that made them who they are today. Today's guest is the frontman with one of the most unique, ambitious and creative bands ever to emerge from the US. They formed in Oklahoma in 1983, and for 30 years the Flaming Lips have been blazing a musical trail across the world, releasing albums which echo the great psychedelic experimentalists of the 70s while blending in pop melodies and their own strain of highly charged surrealism. Their breakthrough came in 1993 with the track She Don't Use Jelly, which marked the start of a run of critically acclaimed and hugely loved albums, like 2002's Yoshimi Battles the Pink Robots and 2006's Brilliant at War with the Mystics. I am pleased to say my guest on the first time this week is Mr. Wayne Coyne. And I started by asking Wayne, as I do with all my guests, when was the first time he was aware of music?
I've thought about that a lot. Of course, you get asked that a lot. You know, it's an interesting, you know, scenario, especially for musicians and you, if you think of yourself as an artist or whatever, you know. But in my house, You know, I have older brothers, four older brothers, an older sister, and my mother liked music a lot, so she played the record player a lot. So I remember these kids' shows. I think one of them was, I think it's called Captain Kangaroo. And they would play this song, Puff the Magic Dragon, by Peter, Paul, and Mary. I'm not sure what year that came out. That one I would hear all throughout my life. When you're really little, this song about Puff the Magic Dragon being, you know, in this kid's imagination, you know, it's, you're the kid, and it's not about imagination, it's about, the dragon is real, you know. But as you get older, you know, some of this music has stayed with me. You realize, you know, that little by little he grows up and he leaves the dragon, and it's crushing. You know, it's too emotional, and I think the way Peter, Paul, and Mary do it, it's so powerful. It almost makes you want to kill yourself, you know.
Oh. Dragon lived by the sea and frolicked in the autumn mist in a land called Hanalei. Puff the magic dragon lived by the sea and frolicked in the autumn mist in a land called Hanalei. Together they would travel on a boat with sail. Jackie kept a lookout perched on Puff's gigantic tail. Noble kings and princes would bow whene'er they came. Pirate ships would lower their flags when Puff roared out his name. Oh, Puff the magic dragon. And giant's rings make way for other toys. One gray night it happened, Jackie Paper came no more. And Puff, that mighty dragon, he ceased his fearless roar. His head was bent in sorrow, green scales fell like rain. In a land called Hanalei. Puff the magic dragon lived by the sea and frolicked in the autumn mist in a land called Hanalei.
I remember that song from kids' shows. Little kid shows, of course, you know, when you're a little kid, that's what you watch. But there was always music around it. I remember when the Beatles first played on the Ed Sullivan Show, I remember my older brothers, we were scurrying to get home. In America, everybody goes to the grocery store together as if it's a big event. And so I remember being, I was born in 1961, so I believe they played in 1964, I believe, yes, you know. So I'm not very old, but I remember us trying to get home to the TV from the grocery store so we could see the Beatles on TV. But I don't remember seeing the Beatles on TV, but I remember seeing the scuttle to get to the TV. Yeah. But I can't really pinpoint a time like, you know, like the Big Bang. Like before this, there was no music, and now there was music. It just sort of seemed like it was always kind of there. But to me, it was more the joy of the music.
Oh, please say to me, I feel happy.
My mother really loved Tom Jones.
What's new, pussycat? Whoa, whoa, whoa. What's new, pussycat? Whoa, 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 whoa.
And when Tom Jones first hit, you know, she would listen to, and they only had a few records. I mean, you know, back then people would have maybe 5 or 6 records, you know, and until my older brother started to buy their own records, my mother bought these Tom Jones records.
Which ones?
I don't remember which. I mean, he's got so many, but those very first ones when he first became popular in America, where he was really, you know, he's young and he's got his hair.
Virile man.
Yeah, and he's really, yeah, and he sings these overly dramatic romantic songs and stuff. See, you don't think that you're really influenced by these things, but you know, sometimes I'll see a Tom Jones picture from that time, and he wears a suit a lot like I do, and he has hair, and you know what I mean. So these things. So much connected probably from the joy that my mother would have from listening to that. And I think that's even more important than what you're listening to. It's the reaction it's having on the people around you. It's like, oh my God. So I think it was probably a combination of Tom Jones, Puff the Magic Dragon, and the Beatles somewhere in the nebulous gray area before I realized music was a thing. You know, it's just another moment that's happening to you when you're so young.
What was the first piece of music that you owned? What was the kind of the first album, the first single?
Well, luckily,
you
know, yeah, you know, my brothers had all the great music. My older brothers and sister and their friends all loved all the great music growing up, you know, in the later 60s and 70s. So, you know, I didn't have to buy any music of my own until really like punk rock came along.
I'm a skeet-walking cheetah with a hat.
But I remember the very first record that they didn't have that I wanted to have was not a very good record, but it had a song on it. I didn't realize it wasn't very good. Or not very good, that's not the right word. It just was, it wasn't very significant after a while for me. It was a Jimi Hendrix record. It has a song on it. I think it's called Peace in Mississippi. It's really freaky, distorted guitar solo sort of track. And for some reason, nobody had it. I mean, they had every other Jimi Hendrix record. And I remember sort of going to the store saying, okay, I'll finally buy it, not realizing that, well, that's what you do. You just go to the store and you buy records, you know. And then after that, you know, I would just get all the records that nobody else, you know, if my brothers didn't have them, little by little running into people. Now, I think as the influence of my older brothers buying records towards the middle of the 70s, and then of course, all the good punk rock stuff started coming out in late 70s and stuff, and then I'm just buying records on my own. Mm-hmm.
You saw The Who live.
Yeah.
Quite, was it 77 or something?
77, like, and this was still with the stellar lineup. I mean, people would, you know, people say by then they were kind of burned out, but on this night they certainly were not.
Wow.
Yeah. I think most people that saw them back then who weren't completely zonked out on drugs, because a lot of people were. Most people, if you were like me, you could not have not been affected by it. I knew their music because my brothers would play Tommy and all their music, but it's not the same as this sort of, you know, this communal experience. And back then, they even had giant lasers and things. I mean, I'm sure they weren't completely legal, but they were giant. And and I, you know, I can still, in my mind, it's one of these movie moments that, you know, remains in your mind. And we didn't even have very good seats. It was quite at the top of this arena. And them doing the, you know, listening to you, I get the music, you know, this thing. And it probably went on for 10 minutes. You know, they get into this thing. And it felt like the arena was going to just collapse because everybody was so into it, stomping their feet, everything, and it was so loud. For me, that seeing The Who, it embraced the audience as if the audience's energy and the audience's life and you know, the things that we all cared about was in the music. But for me, I walked out of that Who concert, you know, I realized now, utterly changed. That made all the difference to me. I want to play music now.
So when you started playing in bands yourself and forming bands, was that something that was very important to you, to try and kind of have that connection with the audience and make it an experience rather than check us out, we're going to rock you?
Well, I think knowing a little, I met Pete Townsend a couple times, and knowing a bit about the way his world worked, you know, he came at music, his father was a musician, and he looked at music as an entertainer. I'm a musician, that's what I do with my life, you know. And I am not, you know, I'm not a musician. My family wasn't musical at all. We listened to music, but mostly just to smoke pot to. It wasn't to play to, you know. And so I never, still don't. I never felt like I really have something to offer you. Now, I, you know, as the group to Flaming Lips, we realized people like our songs, and you don't have this disconnect from it. But early on, you know, it's really just a desire to do it. You don't really think you'll be able to do it, you know. So you form a band, and you really think you'll play through the summer, and it'll all collapse, and that'll be the end of the story. And you would just go back to working at a restaurant, buying records, and that would have been your great summer to have played rock and roll or something. I honestly felt that way up until really just a couple of years ago. I really just sort of felt like, well, you know, we've been lucky, and it's bound to fall apart. The wheels will fall off any minute now, and it'll all be over. A couple of years ago, I started to think, oh, I guess I just shouldn't worry about it anymore. You know, it'll be 30 years next year that we've been together. And I just sort of thought, oh, geez, why worry about it anymore? So I stopped worrying about it being together. I still worry plenty about it being, you know, worthy of the audience's time and money and all that.
I guess If You Don't Use Jelly would kind of be the first breakthrough.
Oh, totally. Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
yeah, yeah.
How did it feel to come from, I'd say, a pretty avant-garde place?
Yeah, yeah.
To suddenly be in the world of, hey, you know, you're kind
well,
of, this is a hit.
You know, we had been going since 1983, and this She Don't Use Jelly hit, it doesn't happen till 1994. And this is where I feel like is really the secret to the Flaming Lips' longevity, is that you get to do these things for a while and sort of sit there and explore them. Mm. So by time we were having this hit, we had kind of done the underground thing, and we had made records by then, and they're being heard by people, but you become curious about this other world of like, well, people get played on the radio, don't they?
Thank you.
You're listening to The First Time with me, Matt Everett, and my guest today, Mr. Wayne Coyne.
Six Music. BBC Six Music. Welcome back to The First Time with me, Matt Everett, and my guest, Flaming Lips frontman Mr. Wayne Coyne. The Flaming Lips' 1999 album, The Soft Bulletin, was the first of their records to really break through into the mainstream, even though it was in fact their ninth album and they'd been together for 16 years by that point. I asked Wayne what it was about that album that made it connect with people in such a big way.
Well, even when I hear it now, without having to remember how it was made or what your, I think it's when you don't know, can't remember your state of mind, it brings back a little bit of like music being magic. When you make music, you know, every time you hear it, you're like, oh, I remember doing this, and it just is a combination of things that you did. It doesn't appear to be this cloud of magic dust like it is when it's someone else's music, you know. But now it's quite old music. You know, we started to make that in 1997. It was just a really lucky bit of timing, because Mercury Rev, who are dear friends of ours, and Jonathan was in the Flaming Lips for a little while, they were having a lot of success with their record called Deserter Songs, which has similar themes, similar sounds, and because we were, all of us were recording with Dave Fridman in the same studio at the same time. They were doing Deserter Songs while we were doing the Soft Bulletin. No one is doing this on purpose, but you know, Mercury Rev would be in there recording, and then they would leave and we'd show up at Dave Fridman's studio, and he would have this sort of new triumphant confidence to say, well, I just did this stuff with Jonathan and them, let's try this stuff. And then we would try stuff, and we would, you know, he would go further up the mountain or whatever, and when Mercury Rev would come in, Dave would again have a more confidence to be like, let's try this. So I think it was a combination of their record and ours being similar, theirs already being popular. And then when our record came out, this sort of, you know, it's hard to say, but there are trends that are happening that you either fall into or you don't. And I think we fell into this trend of this sort of emotional, you know, ethereal, spacey American music.
I wanted to ask you about drugs. I don't know if it's something that you're happy talking about, because I think...
Sure, yeah.
Because the preconception for people that maybe don't know a lot about the band is like, yes, druggy band.
The main thing I think that happens with the idea of drugs and art and music is that you're just willing to try something. You're willing to go for it, you know. And a lot of people who are musicians, they're sensitive. People who are artists, they're sensitive to things. That's why they have to sing about birds and car accidents and things, you know, because they're sensitive to it. They want it to be in their mind, but they want to express it or whatever. But the dilemma of being sensitive, too, is that you just want to sit in the corner. Like me, a lot of times I just want to sit in the corner and draw pictures and write music. I don't really want to go out in the world and say, look at me, you know. So there's the quagmire of being the isolated, you know, sensitive dreamer has to confront the freak that makes you want to go out in front of everybody.
Look at me!
Yeah, and that's usually associated with this other dimension of your personality that says, I'm just going to go for it. And when you say, I'm just going to go for it, I mean, a lot of times that applies to almost everything in your life. It doesn't mean I'm just going to try to be a rock star. I'm going to try to make music. I'm going to try to make my art. You know, I'm going to try to have sex with people. I'm going to do drugs. You know, it just doesn't have any limit, you know. But for me, it was really never like that. You know, I mean, there was a lot of things in my life that I wasn't trying to get from being in a group. I already kind of had a magical life living with my older brothers and sister and their friends and all that. I already was living kind of like Tarzan amongst these super apes, you know, because my younger brother and I were so young and they were living these great experiences and we just got to do everything with them. And we were around people who, you know, in this time in the mid-70s and stuff, there was not anybody in our circle anyway that knew the limits yet. You know, everybody was young-ish, you know. The oldest people around us would have been in their early 20s. And everybody was of the belief that if you didn't take drugs, you were an idiot. You know, you just weren't into what life is now. Which I really regret that now, because my father was a very hardworking, normal guy who could not understand this part of it. He was proud of the idea that you get up and you earn your living and you work hard and you're kind to people. And, you know, there's an element of that. And this lifestyle that my older brothers and their friends, you know, sort of embraced, you know, it just didn't have anything to do with that. But I believe I'm lucky that my mind is actually addicted to this thing that's my art and my music. And if I'm away from it for too long, I do have a reaction, I think, a little bit like a drug addict, where it's like, yeah, it's like, I got to do that. But I realized that when I would take drugs, that there would be some moments when I really liked not being so obsessed or really so driven or whatever. But then it would get to a point where it'd be like, yeah, but I want to go back and make music now. And we don't take drugs when we make music. I think that's probably one of the main things that is different with us. I mean, it's well known that Stephen was a heroin addict for quite a long time. And we made some really stellar music. I mean, the Soft Bulletin was made in this, in the realm of the, you know, his mind being, you know, sometimes devastated by it. But in a sense, I mean, the Soft Bulletin is about that too. You know, it's about this struggle and this love and this intense thing. I mean, within the band, we really do love each other. You know, we really, really do. This isn't a group of narcissistic dudes who, you know, would secretly hating each other. I mean, I love these guys, you know. So when we're in this such an uncertain thing, I mean, this idea that Stephen would survive his heroin addiction, his long heroin addiction, I think it was 7 or 8 years, you know, it's long, long, devastating, devastating, devastating. You know, you get to towards the end of it, and there is only two ways it's going to go, maybe three. I mean, he's either going to die, or he's going to go to jail, or he's going to try to get over it. And this trying to get over it can go on kind of forever. And kind of, what do you do, you know? People would say, well, why don't you just kick him out of the band? That'll show him. It's like, well, show him what? Plus, I want him in the band, you know? But I think because I grew up around drugs my entire life, from the time I was really young, it's always been part of the way we worked, you know? It didn't strike me as being wrong. It's like, well, guys in bands like to get high. I mean, what part of this was new to you? But, you know, on another level, it is very serious, because you think, well, if I allow this thing to keep going and he dies, you know, part of it is like, well, could I have done something? And I didn't. Because you don't know what to do. No one knows what to do. No one knows where any of this sets in their mind, because you just go, let's not talk about it. You know, it'll be fine. Let's not talk about it. Luckily, it never happened. But it's just absurd moments that it lets you settle something in your mind, because you just don't know, well, is this right or is this wrong? And you start to decide, I don't know what's right for everybody else, but this will be right for us, you know?
The lunatic is on the grass. The lunatic is on the grass. Remembering games and daisy chains and laughs. Got to keep the loonies on the path. The lunatic is in the hall. The lunatics are in my hall. The paper holds their folded faces to the floor. And every day the paper boy brings more. And if the dam breaks open many years too soon, and if with the bones too, I'll see you on the dark side of the moon. The lunatic is in my head. The lunatic is in my head. You raise the blade, you make the change, you rearrange me till I'm sane. You lock the door, throw away the key. There's someone in my head, but it's not me.
You've played Dark Side of the Moon, the Pink Floyd album, as a kind of live entity yourself as a band, and Pink Floyd is a band that you've talked about a lot. When did you first hear Pink Floyd? Because I think, once again, there are parallels.
Yeah, yeah.
When did you first hear the Floyd?
My younger brother and I went to a midnight movie, which the theater is still in the neighborhood I live in now. I can't even remember the year now. But we went to a midnight movie to see this movie called A Boy and His Dog. It's known now as, I think, like a druggy sci-fi movie that Don Johnson was in. I think it's his first movie. But the movie that played after it in the movie theater was Pink Floyd's Live at Pompeii. Now, in the scope of what who could possibly have thought this was a good idea for the Pink Floyd movie to come play in a theater in Oklahoma City? I mean, back then people were doing midnight movies and they were becoming quite popular. You know, people would wait in line to see things like the Rocky Horror Picture Show, but not much else. And we sat in this movie theater in Oklahoma City smoking pot, you know, sitting through this dumb Don Johnson movie and going, what is this other movie? We didn't even know it was going to play. We sat in there smoking pot. We were the only two people in the movie theater. My younger brother and I, and this movie comes on. And both of us are like, oh yeah, Pink Floyd, I think I know them. But we didn't know very much of this music that played in Live at Pompeii, you know, because it was previous to Dark Side of the Moon. And literally, if you can have your minds completely, utterly blown, we did, because it's just us, giant screen, sounds great. And it's, I mean, and they play these jams, some of them go on for, you know, 8 or 9 minutes, and it's amazingly well done, you know. So previous to that, there was an awareness of Pink Floyd, but after that, it's never left my mind. I bought a Stratocaster because of that, you know, and I looked at effects, you know, guitar effects, things like, what did he have on the floor there, and echo plexus and all these things that suddenly like, oh yeah, that's how they're making music, because I saw them in that movie, you know. That would be the moment where Pink Floyd, and since then it's forever been, you know, like, yeah, that's great.
Kind of connected to the Pink Floyd thing, if you kind of buy into the Pink Floyd Wizard of Oz myth, that you can watch the Wizard
yes.
of Oz
yeah.
with Dark Side of the Moon in the yeah. background. You've talked about the Wizard of Oz soundtrack being something else that you've that you
well again I think when
you love.
I think there's a time in everybody's life where this exploring of who you are starts to go, well, I want to explore myself back when I was younger. Why? What are these things when I was younger? There's a really, really great reissue of not just the Wizard of Oz soundtrack, but a lot of the making of that as well, outtakes and all these things. And there's a recording of Somewhere Over the Rainbow. Don't think it's in the movie. I think it's an outtake. And even though she's acting, she's crying. It's about longing. You know, it's really not about fantasy. You know, it's really about this other world that she wants to be in so bad. Once I heard it, I mean, I started to cry just hearing it. And we began to play it, you know, live after that. And it would play it at the very, very end of, I mean, this was before we had songs like Do You Realize and stuff. We'd play it at the very end of what sometimes would be a very chaotic punk rock, freaky jam thing. And at the very end of the night, we'd play this and people would literally cry. I would cry when we'd be doing it.
Someday I'll wake and rub my eyes, and in that land beyond the skies, you'll find me. Somewhere over the rainbow, bluebirds fly, birds fly over the rainbow. Why?
On Heady Friends, I mean, how would you describe that record? It's you and a whole really interesting bunch of people that you've worked with. I want to focus in on Yoko Ono, because you've mentioned the Beatles.
Yes, yeah.
A load of times. Mm-hmm. What's it like working with her?
We had played some shows with Sean and Charlotte's group. I believe they're called Ghosts of the Sabretooth Tiger. And we'd been friends with Sean for a while. We'd been friends with Sean, I think, even from the 90s and stuff. And then he's John Lennon's son. Well, you know, I mean, it's just absurd because, you know, part of that you forget because you're just around him and it's great. And so we were just making a plan really to do something with Sean. And he was like, well, we've got the Plastic Ono thing back together. Why don't we see if we can get my mom involved? And I like, yeah, I guess so, yeah. But I also know, because I've been around him and his mother, they'll be talking on the phone or something, that she's intense. I mean, she's still, you know, runs the world like she's 35 years old and it's her deal, you know. And I know that they don't have much time. And I set it up as to whenever they can have us, you know, we'll work with them. So we record with Sean, he'll send it to Yoko and she sends some stuff back and we mix it and send it to her. And luckily, because of working with them, we were able to set up a New Year's Eve show that happened, you know, just this past New Year's Eve, where the, you know, the Plastic Ono band comes and they play two nights with us, you know. And so then you're really with people. And I can say for sure, this idea of Yoko Ono being this entity of like, she's pure and it's about love and it's about music and being creative, it's true. We'll be right back.
It's going to be 30 years of the band.
Yeah.
That's... not a lot of bands get that far.
No, I
how
know.
Does it feel?
Not very much of anything gets that far, I know. Well, you know, for us, it started to seem pathetic at 10 years. You think, oh my God, we've been a band 10 years. You know, because a lot of your favorite groups, you know, they kind of have a moment and then they're gone or whatever. But in truth, you know, there's a lot of groups that are, you know, have gone on. I can think of like Sonic Youth until recently, Sonic Youth and the Beastie Boys until recently, the Red Hot Chili Peppers, U2, the Grateful Dead, you know, had been going forever. You know, so... And there's elements, I think, of all these groups that it becomes like a family. If it doesn't become like a family, I mean, you wouldn't want to be in there. It's in my personality to want to have this family. I think it's because I had this big family and my brothers and my mother always embraced this big thing. We'd have Christmas mornings at our house and there would be 50 or 60 people there, all these friends of my brothers and everything, all there. And my mother took everybody, you know.
This is where it comes from. This is where
I see that now.
From, yeah.
You know, you don't want to believe that early on. You want to believe you're this tough pirate who's making his way in the world. Don't get in my way. But I think little by little I realize it's like that's part of my personality.
So we've had all these firsts and we're going to end with the last song. The last song is a song that we'd like you to choose.
Well, you know, at the end of every Flaming Lips show where we have some say over what happens in the aftermath, we always play Louis Armstrong's version of It's a Wonderful World. Once you put that on, it's not just that it sounds great. I mean, to me, to have a guy like Louis Armstrong, as old as he was, and as all the horrible racist things that he had been through to get to play music in America, where he did, at the time when he did, that despite all this that we know about the world, all this pain, all this horror, all this stuff, we can still stand here and smile and say, what a wonderful world. So it's like, bam, it'll probably stand, for me anyway, as, you know, at the end, that's the moment.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. The colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, are also on the faces of people going by. I see friends shaking hands, saying, how do you do? They're really saying, I love you. I hear babies cry. I watch them grow. They learn much more than I ever knew. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. Yes, I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
This is BBC Radio 6 Music.
After midnight, we're gonna let it all hang out. After midnight, we're gonna chug, lug, and shine. We're gonna cause talk and suspicion, give an exhibition, find out what it is all about. After midnight, we're gonna let it all hang out. After midnight, go.
gonna shake your tambourine. After midnight, it's gonna be peaches and cream. We're gonna cause talk and suspicion, give an exhibition, find out what is a holy bell. After midnight, we gonna let it all hang and suspicion, give an exhibition, find out what it is on lay back. After midnight, we're gonna let it all hang out.
Six music.
Right now, it's the Six Music Jukebox.
This program is a repeat.